We love to get to know our church and to hear from our church, and today actually is all about that. And today is the first ever message in a brand new kind of annual series that we'll do each year called Oceanside's Own. And so we're so excited. I'm so excited about this. This is a series that provides kind of opportunities for three potential groups. One would be just for people in the congregation. It can be just anyone to hear from, and they can reflect on their vocation or give testimony and just kind of hearing from one of our own. And this may be a not quite a preaching message, but more of a sharing time. The second is to provide opportunity for future church leaders, as well as training for those who might be considering vocational ministry. So to give them an opportunity to preach as they're preparing and in study. And then the third group, and as the church grows, we're having more and more of this, where we have a lot of parachurch ministry leaders, Christian leaders, retired pastors and professors and others that attend here at Oceanside, and so we want to hear from them and learn from them as a part of our congregation as well. But today's speaker, the first ever, falls under that second category, and she is studying for a Master's of Christian Ministry at Cary Theological School. Her and her husband Mike have been attending Oceanside since January 2022, so about 3.5 years, and she'll be drawing from some of her studies for today's message, and we are so excited. It takes a lot of courage and bravery to be the first ever Oceanside's Own speaker. So give it up for Trudy Hoskins as she comes and shares.
Well, good morning. So one other important detail about me is that I have four amazing grandchildren, all under the age of 6 years old. And I've noticed one thing they say a lot. And I mean, that's besides, where's Grandpa? Coming in at second place would be, it's not fair. It's not fair, it's my turn. No fair, why do I have to clean up? It's not fair, I wanted that. They declare it so forcefully that it almost makes you believe that they really understand justice, right? Of course, we know that their limited years of experience means that they don't, because they don't have the full picture. Their words are a reaction to unmet expectations and circumstances beyond their control, which from their perspective just isn't right. But as adults, we often aren't much different. It's frustrating and confusing when reality doesn't conform to expectations. And one area where people struggle to find a sense of fairness is the issue of evil and suffering in the world. Marcello mentioned last week how sad it is to hear people say, I just can't understand or to believe in a God that is supposedly good, but who lets so many bad things happen. It goes against our sense of justice that God can, but seemingly doesn't do anything about it. In 2022, my nephew died a tragic accident, leaving a wife and three children, the youngest only 1 month old. His friends and family were devastated and struggled to understand. It didn't seem fair that he would be taken away from his family and that his daughter would never know her dad. Likewise, the recent floods in Texas, which swept away youth from the church camp, have left many asking the question, why? In the Bible, the book of Job tells a story about a righteous man whose life was also marked by great calamity. The title character, Job, is known for his pursuit of answers regarding his situation and his it's not fair sentiments. So this morning, let's journey with Job and see what we can learn from his story about God's justice. Of course, we don't have time to dive into all 42 chapters in detail, but we will do an overview and consider some general insights. The issue of evil and suffering through the story of Job can be approached in four main divisions. The story begins with the declaration that Job was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. Then we drop in on a conversation between God and Satan, where Satan claims Job is only devout because God continues to bless him abundantly, and that Job would surely curse God if he lost everything. So God allows Job to be tested by losing all his possessions, his children, and his health. While greatly grieved and distressed, Job refuses to give up, does not sin, and tells his wife, "Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" It would seem he had a pretty good grasp of the situation. In effect, his response was, "God is in control. We have to take the bad with the good." Then in part two, we find the mood changes when Job's friends come to comfort him. It starts out well. They take the customary time of silence and grieving with him. But then they start making long speeches, accusing him of having done something to bring on his suffering. This transitions Job into a lot of "it's not fair" moments. Job determines that God has some explaining to do and demands to hear from God himself. This goes on a really long time, his friends trying to find out what he did to deserve all of this, and Job maintaining his innocence. Unfortunately, as God will later affirm, Job's friends weren't speaking the truth, and Job was speaking without knowledge. They weren't intentionally lying, they just didn't know what they didn't know. First, they had no idea about the conversation between God and Satan, as this took place in the heavenly realm, so no humans were privy to it. But they also had a confused concept of God and evil. You see, Job and his friends believed in one God, while the Canaanites surrounding them had many gods, good and bad ones. This is significant because the culture of the surrounding people often seeped into the Israelite understanding of God. Expecting God to behave like the other cultures around him, or the other gods around him, complicated the Israelites' ability to understand God's true character. This is evident in Job's friends' insistence that he simply admit to what he did wrong to appease God and get back into his favor, which is exactly what Satan expected him to do. It was a common practice to confess to unknown or uncommitted sins to manipulate the pagan gods. Likewise, the difference between believing in many gods and one God affects expectations regarding evil and suffering. In a society with many gods, the existence of evil can be blamed on the wicked ones. However, in a culture characterized by one holy and just God with extreme power, supreme power, understanding undeserved suffering is harder. There's no other gods to blame for the bad stuff. Similarly, thoughts and expectations of evil were influenced by the principle that righteousness and obedience to the law produced divine blessings, and disobedience was punished. This concept corresponded to the Mosaic covenant with its blessings and curses. However, while this was meant for a nation, it was stretched beyond its intended meaning and applied to individuals, presuming that those who prospered were righteous and those who suffered were wicked. But a strict adherence to this belief didn't always reflect experience, creating tension and confusion, as in the book of Job, where a righteous, obedient man is subject to extreme suffering. In chapter 38, we also find God correcting them regarding creation and how that works. Their strict application of this blessing-punishment principle indicated that they believed that that was just programmed into creation, left to operate consistently on its own. But God's discourse to Job reveals that sometimes it works because he intervenes, indicating a less predictable and more multifaceted system than Job had realized. Suffering isn't something humans can understand by applying a simple formula. God is active and involved in the world. John Golden Gay says, "Sometimes suffering does come from a person's sin. But where Job's friends went wrong is that they misunderstood the complexity of the overall principle and turned a general concept into a concrete rule." In addition, in verse 2, God accuses Job of obscuring God's plan with words without knowledge. God did this by putting himself and his problems in the center of the universe, questioning God's wisdom and justice, and implying he could do better. However, the creation runs with God in the center of the universe. So we can see there's a few misunderstandings in play at this story. Job and his friends didn't know about the conversation between God and Satan. There was a skewed view of God. The blessing-punishment principle was incorrectly applied to Job's situation, and they expected the created order to behave differently. The New Bible Commentary says, Job and the others were trying to fit together all the pieces of a puzzle without having all the pieces within their grasp. We see how the book of Job shows the difficulties of reducing the complex problem of human suffering to some consistent, predictable pattern. So God eventually shows up to correct their misunderstanding with some reality. In chapter 38, God enters the scene in a storm, a common symbol of his power, and he sets the record straight concerning his vast wisdom and authority versus Job's limitations. Chapter 38 to 41 are filled with examples of the complexities of the world which God created as God challenges Job. He asked Job, where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? On what were its footings set? Or who laid the cornerstone while the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? In chapter 38, verse 21, he says, surely you know, for you were already born. You've lived so many years. So God's reality check from Job's reality check from God resets Job's thinking, which takes us to the fourth stage of this story, where Job returns to trusting God and the relationship is restored. In chapter 42, Job responds, I know that you can do all things. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my plans without knowledge? Surely I have spoken of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. In other words, you're right, there's so much I don't understand. You're orchestrating a performance more magnificent than I could ever imagine. You have a good plan. I need to trust that. Job realizes that he was wrong to demand an answer from God and that God's power and wisdom are truly beyond his understanding. God then validates Job and gets angry at his friends for the nonsense that they'd been spouting. At this point, Job comes full circle. Think about it. Before the arrival of his friends, Job trusted God, accepted his tragedies. Remember, he told his wife, shall we accept good from God and not trouble? He grieved appropriately, he blessed God, and he did not sin. When his friends arrived with their relentless lectures, they sent him into a tailspin in a persistent pursuit of why. But God speaks some serious truth to him, and armed with clarity regarding his limitations and God's immenseness in power and wisdom, Job recommits to trusting God, no longer worrying about why God didn't handle things differently, despite God never providing him an answer to that question, why. By God not explaining the reason to Job, Job had to just walk by faith. He remained faithful to God without understanding the reasons for evil, because he had a clear understanding of God. Plus, Job scored the win for God as he proved Satan wrong. He maintained his faith even when he wasn't being blessed and not getting the answers he was seeking. John Goldengay says, Job's task is to accept his trouble on the basis of his relationship with God and on the basis of acceptance of his limits and trust in God. The story concludes with God restoring Job's wealth, family, and health without an explanation for Job's losses. There's a lingering understanding of suffering being a mystery involving factors beyond the limitations of human understanding. And Job is refocused on his relationship with God, replacing the need for answers with trust in God. But you may be thinking, wait, I was expecting a discourse on the problem of evil and suffering. All you've got is that it's too hard to understand, that there's no explanation other than there's no explanation. Well, sometimes there are reasons, such as suffering being a consequence of sinful humans abusing their free will, but there's no one size fits all. Some things just don't make sense without an eternal perspective. What I think the story of Job shows us is why evil is the wrong question. Evil is only a problem from our vantage point, but God is so much bigger and so much more powerful. And from the perspective of eternity, it's not an issue. It's already been defeated. Maybe the better question is how. The actual problem of evil is not evil in the world, but the childish expectation that we are the center of the universe and have all the puzzle pieces, thus obscuring God's true character and questioning his sovereign management of this complex world. Last week, Marcello hit on an antidote to this issue when he talked about the importance of going beyond spiritual milk, taking ownership of our faith, and developing a transformative understanding of who God is so we can trust him in all circumstances. Timothy Keller writes, "It's one thing to have an intellectual explanation for why God allows suffering. It is another to actually find a path through suffering so that instead of becoming more bitter, cynical, despondent, and broken, you become more wise, grounded, humble, and even content." This path is through the person of Jesus Christ. He says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Through Jesus and his Holy Spirit walking with us in our trials, we can find a way through. Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." When we focus on God's power and wisdom and trust him over our own limitations and distorted fear and restore God in place of ourselves in the center of the universe, we can become more wise, grounded, humble, strong, and content. Following my nephew's death, I stayed with the family to help. During that time, I was so grateful that Jesus partnered with me, his presence there every step of the way. He provided strength, wisdom, and a heart filled with God's love beyond what I could imagine as I cared for them in the early days of their shock and grief. I was comforted knowing God was grieving with us and so thankful for his love shown through my church family with meals, prayers, cards, and messages. Prayer warriors were always on hand to respond to any requests. The situation was terrible, yet Jesus was amazing. I couldn't imagine trying to get through it without him. No answers to the reason for the suffering would have brought me the light into the darkness that Jesus did for me then. I am so grateful that he had been a trusted friend long before this tragedy struck. Knowing from experience that he had the puzzle pieces that I didn't, and I could trust him to guide me through, was invaluable. We live in a very self-centered versus God-centered society. Things like control, money, achievements, influence have become the gods worshipped by the culture surrounding us. Like Job's friends, those gods infiltrate our thinking, and our expectations of God to behave like them obscures our view of his divine nature and hinders our relationship with him. Remember how Job's relationship with God was solid? Until his friends arrived with their mixed up theology. We need to be careful about who and what we listen to. Likewise, by placing ourselves in the center of the universe, we seek our comfort and pleasure versus God's will. This creates a hybrid spirituality, mixing our Christian beliefs with other practices such as occult or Eastern mysticism as it suits our purposes. For example, some Christians consult astrology, tarot cards, and other forms of fortune telling, not realizing that it's contrary to scripture. These practices of seeking guidance and knowledge through other sources are a challenge to God's authority and are strictly prohibited in the Old Testament. They're also contrary to Jesus' teaching about God's sovereignty. By placing God in the center of the universe, we recognize him as our source of wisdom and direction. And when we truly know him, we know that he's all we need. We exist to glorify God. God doesn't exist to arrange life in a way that satisfies our selfish desires and preconceived ideas. God is our source of wisdom. We can't stand outside of his presence and will, holding on to secular God, shouting, "It's not fair," and expect things to come into focus. Our cultural sense of entitlement demands accountability from God for things that we don't understand, such as evil in the world. Like children, we want things our way. However, we can be grateful that God is wise beyond measure, more powerful than evil, and greater than our ability to understand his ways. More important than understanding what God does or does not do is understanding who he is. Like Job, when we see God through a pure filter, untainted by the influence of the secular world, we see the enormity of his wisdom, power, and love. Then we can know with confidence that he has a good plan and can be trusted. So let's release our grip on the secular gods and seek the transformative understanding of God so that we can trust him in all circumstances. Romans 12:2 sums it up. It says, "Do not conform to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will."